So we've had a couple of presentations why of course nominal things or constructs. Remember they said that in generally speaking constructs can be divided into those which refer to existing things and those which refer to things which don't exist. But generally speaking you have to say that constructs do exist. Okay? So when the commentaries such as older commentaries on the sutra in which the Buddha explained the intent of his sutras start explaining that, you know, with regard to dependent things, the Buddha in this sutra said they are neither truth, right? They neither exist ultimately nor do they exist nominally. And then they went on to say again, there was another section that it said empty things, what do you call it, totality things, that they do exist nominally but they don't exist ultimately, which is the opposite of what's correct. And those on those two points, the great commentaries on the sutra in which the Buddha explains the intent of his sutras are wrong. Just a couple. This is all in response to a claim that somebody has said, right, that constructs don't exist. Right, people are claiming that somebody in the mind-only school might end up saying that constructs don't exist at all, because not being in either one of the two truths, they would have to not exist at all. So, and then Jetsu Kapa says, you know, those commentaries have been wrong on other points as well. It wasn't just on this point that they were wrong. For example, they say that things. What was it? They say that the mind-only school does say that our external things exist, right? And we know according to the presentation by in Tekdu, right, by Master Asanga, that they in the compendium by Master Asanga, that he says they're distinctly quoting the original sutra that those things don't exist. This school says that external objects don't exist. So it's obvious that these commentaries have been wrong on those points, and they're probably wrong on the other points as well. And then to rub it in, you know, Jetsun Kapa starts quoting also Master Asanga two different places. He quotes Bodhisattva levels, and then he quotes the abbreviation, and he says in these two places as well, you know, they describe constructs as being existing things. Admitted, there are certain constructs which don't refer to existing objects, but in general you have to say that all constructs do exist. And also admittedly they exist only nominally, but you still have to say that they exist. Okay, they may not exist ultimately, but they do exist nominally. Therefore, they exist. So, for all these reasons, for the reason that the original sutra indicated that constructs do exist, for the reason that Master Sangha's two works, even three works, Master Sangha on two different commentaries is saying that they do exist, that constructs do exist, even though they exist only nominally. Therefore, you cannot say that the intent of the sutras, right, was to say that constructs don't exist at all as a group. Now we have on the last line of page 50 and on the beginning line of page 51, some of the guys are coming up and saying, look, why are you complaining about the commentaries to the sutra in which the Buddha explained the intent of his other sutras? You know, why are you doing that? Why are you complaining about that? Everybody knows that it was written by Master Sangha himself. Okay, and Geshe-la points out that there are catalogs to the Tengyur in which the great commentary to the sutra in which the Buddha explained the intent of his other sutras is supposedly written by Master Sangha. It says in those, you know, I've also seen it. There's also some that say supposedly written by Master Sangha. But anyway, there are catalogs to the Tengyur where it says this book was written by Master Sangha. Then Jetsun Kapa says, anyone who claims that this book, that these mistaken commentaries, or you know, commentaries and mistakes in them, were written by Master Sangha, hasn't looked into the matter very well. Okay, Matakso means, Matabachembo means, they have grossly failed to look into the matter at all. Page 51, first line. Why? For several reasons. First of all, what's stated in those, in that great commentary to the sutra on the intent of the sutras, and what's stated in the Bodhisattva levels, and what's stated in the abbreviation, are all at odds with each other. Okay? Like, if you set on one side this commentary to that sutra, and if you set on the other side these two known commentaries by Master Sangha, they seem to be completely saying different things. They seem to be totally contradicting each other. And like, Master Sangha is not the kind of person to contradict himself in three different books. Okay? So that's one indication. Secondly, it's we find in that commentary on the sutras, right, on the intent of the sutras, we find a quotation. They quote Master Dharmakirti, who, by the way, Westerners say lived around 600, 700 AD. Master Asanga is 350 AD. So he said, you know, that book quotes Master Dharmakirti, you know. So even historically, the claim that that book was written by Master Arya Asanga is wrong, you know, from point of view of style, from point of view of content, from point of view of historical, you know, possibility. He couldn't have written it. Anybody who says that hasn't looked into the matter. And then Geshe-la brings up another possible objection. Somebody might come and say, it's no problem that Master Asanga is contradicting himself here, because remember, like, he's really a Madhyamikan in mind-only sheep's clothing, you know? Like, everybody knows he's really a Madhyamika thinker who's just presenting the mind-only school for his whole life, you know? And then they say, well, even if he were, you know, even if that may be the case, right? That could be the case. But in these three books, he's purporting to present the ideas of the mind-only school. He begins by saying, I'm going to present the ideas of the mind-only school. So it's not like he's going to throw in Madhyamika in some books where he's supposedly presenting only the mind-only school. So that's not a justification for why there might be some contradictions here. The fact is, he didn't write it because of the time is impossible, the subject matter is impossible, and the style is different also. Jetsukapa says, I'll give you another reason why Master Sangha never wrote that book, okay? He did write the book called The Abbreviation. In the book called The Abbreviation, that book treats the entire sutra on the intent of the sutras in great detail, except for one chapter. There are 10 chapters in that sutra. One chapter is called a story about how the book was written or why the book was written, or usually it's something like that, okay? Nowadays it means the foreword of a book is called a Lengshi or a Lengja. So he says, aside from that chapter, you know, which is not like the biggest chapter there, all other 9 chapters of the 10 chapters of the original sutra in which the Buddha explains the intent of the sutras, he covers every chapter. You know, he pulls out quotations from each of those 9 chapters. He talks about them in detail, and in particular, he goes after difficult points in those chapters. So he rips apart. He goes in and he delves into them. So there's no need. There's no reason why Master Asanga would have gone and written another commentary on the same subject. You see, so you can't say that he wrote what's called the Great Commentary on the sutra in which the Buddha explains the intent of the sutras, because he did write the abbreviation, which turns out to be a really big, long book, about, you know, in great detail about the contents of that sutra. So there's no reason why he would have finished that, you know, and then started another commentary on the sutra, you know. Okay, so it doesn't make sense. It's just a comment.
Yagi
Now on page 51 on the fifth line, Chigikachi Kyang means, and also there have been later people who showed up later, you know, later thinkers and later debaters who've shown up later and made similar mistakes or similar claims, right? What are those claims? First one is that the first of the three attributes of the Minoy school, right, which is constructs, that would come along and say that constructs exist neither ultimately nor do they exist relatively. They exist neither ultimately nor nominally, neither ultimately nor deceptively, which is in effect to say that they don't exist. Some people have come up and said that's what the mind-only school thinks about constructs. When you get to the middle one, meaning the middle of the three attributes, which is shenwangs, right, dependent things, well, then they say, oh, they do exist nominally, but they don't exist ultimately, which is also a reversal, right? And then they come up to this last one, they say, which is totality or emptiness, and they say, it does exist ultimately, but that's all, okay? Then some people, these later debaters, have come along and said, this is the true intent of Tomekuchi. Tomekuchi means a sangha and the brother, meaning a sangha and his half-brother, Master Basabandhu, okay? So when they were in mind-only school sheep's clothing, then that's what they believed and that's what they said. Now this is basically exactly the same positions that are being expressed by whoever wrote the commentary on the sutra, on the intent of the sutras. And so really it's just the same error over again. It's the same misreporting of the concepts or the positions of the mind-only school. Who is it? And then he goes on to say, anyone who thinks that has dropped out of this system. Okay, there's an expression in Tibetan which is they have gone to the outside of the system, meaning they've lost the system. They've gone to somewhere else. Okay, they may have gone somewhere else, but they're not in the mind only system anymore. So whoever reports this as being the intention of the mind only school has in effect dropped out of the mind only system, the mind only school. Now, who are these later people that Jetsun Kapa is talking about? Geshe-la identifies them as Bhutan Tamje Khyenpa Rinchen Drup. Bhutan Rinpoche, who was instrumental in, by the way, instrumental in designing the congruent, you know, putting them together, okay? And he was about a generation and a half before Jetsun Kapa. He is a renowned scholar of Madhyamika. He understood the middle way school very well. He wrote good books about it. His description of that is correct. When he got to the mind-only school, when he got to reporting what the mind-only school believed, he didn't describe it correctly. Okay, he didn't get it right, and he did, for example, say these three things that two of them are not correct about the mind-only school. So that's who Jetsun Kapa is obliquely referring to. Okay, I guess I was looking for that quotation from Dharmakirti that shows up in that book just to prove to you that it's there. Okay. In his free time.
Tama
Then Jetha Kapa lays a
further fault on these guys. You know, he's rubbing it in even more. He says, by the way, what did you say again about the dependent things? And they said, we said that the mind-only school says that dependent things don't exist ultimately, but do exist relatively, or do exist nominally. And then he says, and what did they mean when they said exist nominally? And he says, oh, what they mean when they say exist nominally is that when you look at something like a vase, if it appears to you to be, it appears to a mistaken state of mind that it is arising and stopping, but in truth it's not arising and stopping like that. Okay, so to a mistaken state of mind, it appears to be beginning and ending in a certain way, but that's not the way it's really ending and beginning. Now don't forget that this is exactly how the middle way school was describing the word deceptive in deceptive reality, and then don't forget that the mind-only school attacked them for saying that, you know, and saying that that was correct or something like that. So here we go, someone reporting the mind-only school as saying, you know, the reason why dependent things, we can say that they exist nominally, is that they exist, they are said to start and they are said to stop with regard to a mistaken state of mind. If the mind weren't mistaken, they wouldn't see it stopping and starting that way. Since it is starting, it seems to be starting and stopping that way to this state of mind, that's why we call it nominally existing. So they've totally introduced something that the mind-only school never ever said at all and would never ever accept. And they are aggravating their error. And Jetha Kapa says, look, you know, you're getting worse and worse, you know. Okay. Listen.
She
So now they go on to say, well, how do you establish that nominally existing thing again, right? They say Shen Wangs are nominally existing but not ultimately existing. They report the mind-only school as saying that. Who's they, Buddha Rinpoche, so far? Okay, and they're saying, changing things or dependent things do exist, they do exist nominally but don't exist ultimately. Okay, and what do you mean when you say nominally? Nominally means they appear to start and to stop to a mistaken state of mind, but in actuality, they do not have any such starting or stopping. So then Jetson Kapa jumps on these guys and says, hey, wait a minute, you just did a kundam, okay? You accused us of doing that, but now you yourselves are canceling Shenwangs, right? Shenwangs really do exist, and now you're saying that the mind-only school says they don't exist. So you just did one of those tricks where you say that something that really does exist doesn't exist. You're discounting, aren't you? You know, you first you accused the poor middle school guys of discounting. Now here you are doing it yourself. According to you, then the mind-only guys themselves would be the ultimate discounters, because they'd be saying it's only to a mistaken state of mind that the stopping and the starting of things begins. And if the mind ever straightened out, it realized that those things don't stop and don't start, meaning that they're not dependent things, they're not cause things, and then they'd be canceling the very basis on which we establish constructs and emptiness. So you know, if you want to choose anybody to be a discounter, right, someone who's discounting improperly, it's you guys when you're reporting the mind-only school's beliefs. Then Jensen Kappa goes on to another complaint. He says, by the way, and on this complaint, he's lumping in the Jonamba with Bodhi Rinpoche, because on this point, Jonamba holds a very similar position to Bodhi Rinpoche. So whatever Bodhi Rinpoche has said here, Jonamba is very close to that. Okay, and what is his complaint to both of them? He says, by the way, and you, Jonamba, right? Weren't you the one who said that the third turn of the wheel, right? The sutra in which the Buddha explains the intent of his other sutras is Nidun, right? Is to be taken literally, right? Didn't you say that? And he says, oh yeah, I did say that. He says, oh yeah, doesn't that sutra say that constructs do exist? And doesn't it further say that changing things do exist by definition? And it never said they exist just nominally or something like that. Doesn't it say that? And he says, oh yeah, it does say those two things. Constructs do exist, and changing things do exist by definition, and not just nominally, right? It says that. The sutra says that. Aren't you the guy who said we had to take that literally? He says, oh yeah, I did. He says, here, like, there's even a bigger error, you know? You've got even a bigger contradiction in your own system than before. Because on the one hand, you say that we have to take this sutra literally, and then when it says that, then that sutra goes ahead and says, literally, that constructs do exist, and that they're not such that they don't exist, right? By the way, why did they say they didn't exist? They said, with regard to both truths, neither truth applies to constructs. So you've got that problem, now you've got the second problem, you're misreporting everything, and you've got a bigger contradiction than you ever started out with.
Okay.
Nothing. Turn the film forward, okay? Advance the roll. That's what he's trying to say. Advance the roll and we'll go on to the next. We're on to another big section now. We're moving on to a separate section. Second line from the bottom, page 51, we've reached a section called, refuting attempts to show that our own system has contradictions, is contradictory. Now, who is refuting what? Don't forget that the whole exchange started out by the mind-only school criticizing the middle way school. And then the middle way school criticized them back. They gave a counterattack. They said, hey, wait a minute, you know, your own school has these other problems, you know. Your own presentation has all these other problems. Now you get the mind-only school coming back again and defending themselves against the counterattack of the middle way school. Okay, so now they get to come back and say, no, our school doesn't have those problems. Our school doesn't have those inconsistencies, okay? This is going to be that section. Second line from the bottom, page 51.
Geshe-la's referring back to the quotation to the comment on the last line of page 50 where it says, anyway, the book quotes Dharmakirti in his book called it's called Pramana Samuchaya, the Samuchaya, or the, I'm sorry, Vinischaya, which means the distinction between these two things. So he says, you know, he quotes that book where Dharmakirti is making distinctions. It's called Making Distinctions. So how could he have done that? And Geshe-la says, well, for one thing, they are separated by many generations. You know, he says, I don't have the exact dates or anything like that, but by the time that Dharmakirti, when Master Sangha was writing his book, or supposedly writing this book,
Dharmakirti still hadn't shown up in his mommy's tummy yet. So how could he be quoting Master Dharmakirti if they're separated by many generations of time? Secondly, I was hoping to find that actual quotation and share it with you, but I'm having trouble finding it right now, and I'll try to pull it out this evening and try to give it to you tomorrow.
Now, the first part of this section is going to be the actual arguments posed by the non-mind only. So I said, oh, Geshe-la, you're talking about the Manyamika school is doing their counter-texts. Hey, it doesn't have to be the Manyamika school, okay? It could be anybody. And it says, usually they don't even bother to identify who it is. It's just a generic complaint about the mind-only school, okay? It doesn't matter. We don't have to really identify who it is. It could be different people, but they're all going to be attacking the mind-only school and saying, hey, you know, your own presentation has these holes in it. And I can show you why your own presentation has contradictions in it. So, you know, they don't really go into identifying who it is. It's just somebody trying to demonstrate to the mind-only school. It's not necessarily a direct counterattack. It's certain groups are coming to the mind-only school and saying, you know, your presentation has its own contradictions. Your presentation has its own problems. Who is that? And what? They're going to use books of the mind-only school to blow holes in the mind-only school, okay? So they're going to use five different references. You know, we're going to go through in detail five different references that are used as ammunition against the mind-only school's own presentation. What's the first one? They're going to quote the sutra in which the Buddha explained the intent of his sutras itself, okay? That's going to be the first one. The second one is going to be called the
Madhyanta Vibhanga, and it's called, it's the distinction between the extremes and middle and the extremes. I think it's a book by Master Sangha. Then you're going to end Maitreya. And then you're going to get a book called Dodegyen, which is Sutra Alamkara, which is called the Jewel of the Sutras or something like that. By the way, in between there, you're going to get as well a commentary on separating the middle from the extremes. Okay, so now you've got four, right? You've got the original sutra, separating the middle from the extremes, a commentary on separating the middle from the extremes. Then you're going to have Sutra Alamkara, the Jewel of the Sutras. And then finally, you're going to get another quotation from the abbreviation itself. So you're going to have five different quotations that blow holes, particularly in the idea that the mind-only school says that changing things or dependent things exist ultimately. Because all of those five references, in some way or another, are going to be concentrating on the idea that they don't exist ultimately. Okay, they're going to be, these are mind-only books, these are mind-only references, and in each of these references you can find statements to the effect that dependent things do not exist ultimately. So who's right, and is there a contradiction here or not? So here begins the attack on the mind-only school. This is pretty cool. They're quoting the sutra on the intent of the sutras. And that sutra is examining the nature of the eight components of the Arya path. Okay, this is one of the 37 elements of enlightenment that we talked about before. We had all these different groups, and finally we said, this is the final one actually, the eight components of the Arya path. Okay, and when they got to the eight components of the Arya path, that sutra says, by the way, look at these eight components. They are separate things. They are discrete things from each other. A. B. They are all coming from their causes and conditions. Okay? They grow from their causes and conditions. Okay? Now, consider the emptiness or the Yongdrup, right? The totality of those eight things. Those totalities also, or those emptinesses that pertain to each separate one, are in themselves also separate. Okay? They are discrete one from another. And in that way, they resemble the eight elements. But if you were to go further and to say that those eight emptinesses also grow from their causes and conditions, okay, then you would be saying that those things are produced, that those eight emptinesses are produced things, right? If you said that they are produced from causes, that they have their own causes and conditions, as do the things which they refer to, okay? And in that case, you would have to be saying that they were not something that existed ultimately, because everybody knows that if something is produced, it cannot exist ultimately. End quotation from the sutra. Okay. What has the sutra just said? The sutra has just said, if they happened to be produced things, then they couldn't exist ultimately. And Jetsukapa rubs it in and says, aha, this sutra now is saying, if you're a produced thing, you can't exist. You cannot exist ultimately. And it's using that as a proof of why those eight emptinesses can't be changing things, or can't be produced things. Okay, so there's one example where your own school, there's something in sutra which is contradicting your own school. The sutra which you guys love to use turns around on you and says, if you're a produced thing, you can't be ultimate. Okay, you can't be existing ultimately. Okay, nothing. Mm-hmm. So to summarize the problem here, or the issue here, Jetsun Kapa is pointing out that according to that sutra itself, once something is a produced thing, it cannot be existing ultimately, says the sutra. And there's another quotation from Maitreya's own, our protector Maitreya's own book called, Dividing or Distinguishing the Middle from the Extremes, right? And in that book, there's a line that says, the ultimate one is only one. Okay? The ultimate one is only one. And that quotation is referring to the three attributes of the mind-only school and saying that only one out of three, if we take it literally, okay, apparently it's saying that out of those three attributes or categories, only one of them is ultimate. And the commentary to that text further says, no, we didn't get to it yet. Listen. So if you take these words on their face value, they seem to be saying only yongdrup, only totality or emptiness is something which exists ultimately. And the implication there is that the other two don't exist ultimately, and meaning that dependent things don't exist ultimately, according to this quotation, if you take it on face value. And the commentary to that text, the commentary to the text called Dividing the Distinguishing the Middle from the Extremes, right? The commentary itself also says, by the way, what this short phrase means in the root text is that the only thing that exists ultimately is totality or emptiness. And you should understand that that's the only one that exists ultimately. Okay, that truly exists ultimately. Okay, you should realize that that's the case. Okay? So really, what the commentary says about the root text and what the root text seems to say by itself are exactly the same. And then we're going to get a quotation from the Jewel of the Sutras, right? And it's going to start out by saying, it is not commentary on these words is going to come later. It's a very, very difficult word by itself. All it says here is that it is not something which exists. What that means is that what they're going to gloss it as meaning later is that once something comes from its causes and conditions, it cannot be included among ultimate things. Okay? Once...
Nothing.
Geshe-la says, oh, what the heck, let's go in and explain each syllable of this extremely difficult quotation, okay? Now, when it says, it starts out by saying, it's not something which exists, it's not something which doesn't exist, okay? We're referring to the ultimate, okay, to ultimate things. Whatever it means to be ultimate is what they're talking about. Now, you can refer back to those five attributes of Yongdrup or totality that we had before. These are very, very similar, okay? We had them back up there a ways, okay? And they were talking about the first one, Yur, means, is it the case that, for example, a water pitcher and the emptiness which pertains to that water pitcher are one and the same? You know, are they like inseparable? Are they just simply one object? Are the water pitcher and the emptiness that the water pitcher exhibits, are they one and the same thing? No, they are separate. So you cannot say they exist as one and the same thing. And that's what it means when the quotation says they do not exist. They are not something which exists, meaning they are not something which exists as one and the same thing. A water pitcher and the emptiness which pertains to it, those two things are not something which exists as one thing, okay, as a single object. Next it says meimin, which means neither are they something that doesn't exist. This means neither are they something that doesn't exist with a relationship of what we call one identity, or something like that. A single relationship of identity. What that means, that kind of relationship means that if you remove one, the other is automatically removed. Okay, you can call it one identity or something like that. So neither is it the case that they do not share a relationship of identity, meaning if you do remove a vase from the universe, you do remove all the emptinesses of vases from the universe. If there were no vases, there would be no emptinesses of vases. So although they are not one object, and although they are separate things, they do have such a relationship such that if you removed one, you would remove the other. Okay, so they do have an essential relationship. So it's not the case that they exist as separate things, and neither is it the case that they do not exist as things which are almost inseparably related. Okay, then it says deshin minshin min, meaning and by the same token, neither are they something other or something. Neither are they something both or something other, okay? Neither are they something unrelated to those two things, okay? That's not the case either. So they neither exist, they neither not exist, nor do they both exist and not exist, neither do they neither exist nor not exist, okay? None of those is the case. Now, still talking about ultimate objects, okay? Still talking about what is ultimate, okay? It is not something which starts, it is not something which stops, okay? It is not something which can be, which has any beginning, and it is not something which stops, okay? Which perishes, okay? Now, this already, this is the crucial phrase right here where it says, it doesn't start and it doesn't stop, okay? This is the crucial phrase because now we're eliminating the description ultimate with regard to produced things, meaning shenwangs, meaning dependent things, right? So once you start saying that, hey, if the thing is ultimate, it cannot start and it cannot stop, you're already eliminating shenwang, right? Okay, according to the mind-only school. Then it says there's no lessening and there's no increasing, okay? And Geshe-la explains it very nice. You know, these are famous words from the Heart Sutra also. And what it means is, for example, when you start studying more and more, and your level of knowledge and your level of understanding gets greater and greater, or if you study less and less and your level of understanding starts to degenerate, right, and your knowledge starts to degenerate, when the knowledge starts to degenerate, does the emptiness which pertains to that knowledge in any way degenerate? Does it in any way lessen or become 30% or 20%, you know, something like that? No, it does not, okay? It's still perfect 100% emptiness, okay? So in that sense, the ultimate is without lessening. And the opposite is true. The converse is the opposite is true as well. When your knowledge or when your level of learning gets higher and higher and higher, is it the case that the emptiness of that level of learning gets higher and higher? No, it's always either empty or not empty. It's not either. It's not less empty or more empty. Okay, and that's another description of the nature of the ultimate. So now and then they say, and that's what the nature of the ultimate is. That's what ultimate means. So there's that long explanation from the jewel of the sutras wherein they're explaining that things that are described as ultimate cannot be all of those things. And among there, in there, is a statement that there cannot be things that begin and things that end, which automatically disqualifies shenwang. So there's another problem with your presentation, you mind only guys. Okay? That's okay. This is pretty cool. Now we're on to page 53, second line. It says, moreover, the abbreviation says, okay? And then it says, Gyuten Kunzop Du Yopa. Now we have to talk about the word Gyuten. Normally Gyuten means reason or justification or something like that, okay? And Geshe-la glosses it in a wholly different way. He says, Gyuten means, refers to results, okay? Those things which exhibit a characteristic of possessing a cause. Okay, so he's taking gyu and sen, okay? Those things which show or indicate having causedness, okay? Which refers to what? Which refers to results. And what does your classic result belong to? What group? Dependent things, shenwang things. So gitsen here is a code word for dependent things, okay? And then the book says, kunzo tu yupa jupa cha, dunda tu yupa jupa chashina, which is where the abbreviation, in the abbreviation there's a rhetorical question, you know. Hey, let's talk about shenwangs. Let's talk about dependent things, you know. Are they something that exists deceptively, or are they something that exists ultimately? And then dua itself, the abbreviation itself, answers, they are something which exists deceptively. Okay? So there you go, mind-only school. Now you got this other problem to deal with. Moreover, the same book later on says, constructs are also something that exists. You know, it asks the same rhetorical question. Are concepts something that exists deceptively, or are concepts something that exists ultimately? And it answers its own question saying, concepts are something that exists deceptively. So here you go again, you have a problem. Okay, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, I blew that one, okay? Concepts, the abbreviation says, concepts are something which does exist ultimately, and don't exist deceptively. Yeah? Yeah. Okay, yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry. Let's start that again. I blew that. Erase that whole last section, okay? It doesn't say constructs. It says constructing state of mind, okay? So sorry about that. So then the abbreviation comes up and says, okay, having said that about dependent things in general, let's talk about the constructing state of mind, okay? Is the constructing state of mind something that exists deceptively, or is it something that exists ultimately? And the answer is, it exists deceptively. Okay? Dua's own answer, the abbreviation's own answer is, it exists deceptively. So here in two cases, one in the general category of dependent things, and secondly, in a state of mind which belongs to that category of all dependent things, the same answer has come up. So these other guys, whoever they are who are attacking the mind only at this moment, are saying, hey guys, you know, they didn't say in there it was ultimate, right? They asked a rhetorical question, and nobody answered those two things were ultimate, so I think your presentation's wrong, okay? That's another example of how their presentation is wrong. Now Joseph Kopp is going to, it looks like he's jumping to the defense of the Mainoni school, okay? He says, the question so far posed by these other guys, right, which ends on line 7, page 53. The other guys are saying, well, could you explain to me why this is not a contradiction? You know, everything you said before about all these shenwangs, all these dependent things being something that existed by ultimately, and now all of these references saying they don't exist ultimately, okay? Then can you explain this apparent contradiction to me or not? And then Jetson Kappa jumps in and says, on line 7, page 53, he says, hey, I can help you out. I can explain why there's no contradiction here, okay? And he seems to be jumping to the defense so far, okay? What does he say? He says, hey, guys, you got to realize one thing. When you say something exists ultimately, or when you say something exists deceptively, there are two different interpretations of what that means, okay? There are two different ways of describing what it means when we say this exists or this exists deceptively. There are two different ways to explain that. Nothing.
Nothing.
No, sir.
Mm-hmm.
So there are two ways of describing what these two expressions mean. First, I'll give you the way that the first way describes both of them, and I'll show you the way that the second way describes both of them. Okay, so the first one is, the first way of describing both of these two expressions is the meaning of something existing deceptively is that it is only a construct. It is only something which is a creation of our imagination or of our projections. Okay, it's something that our mind is constructing in a way, and that's what it means for something to exist only nominally or only deceptively here. So when we say in the first way of explaining the expression, this thing only exists deceptively, is to say this thing is only a creation of your projections. Okay, that's the first way of explaining it. And then when you go on in the first method of explaining to what is the meaning of something existing ultimately, you just turn it around. Okay, it is not something that only exists by virtue of our projections or our labeling. Okay, rather it exists from its own side through its own unique way of being. And that's the first way of describing those two expressions. What two expressions? To exist deceptively and to exist ultimately. In Jetsu Kapa's defense of the mind only, okay? Nyingyatso Kapa says, by the way, this is very similar to the presentation we had above of the middle turning of the wheel. Remember in the middle turning of the wheel, Lord Buddha said nothing exists by definition, right? And then in the third turning of the wheel, they go into the middle turning of the wheel and they start to divide, oh, he really meant it about that and he didn't really mean it about that. Okay, they start saying, with regard to, for example, dependent things or changing things, when Lord Buddha said they didn't exist by definition, he meant they really did exist by definition. He wasn't saying that. Okay, when he said everything is just a projection, or everything is just a creation of your mind, he was not talking about changing things at that point. So remember back when we had that argument where the mind-only school was trying to distinguish between the things that Lord Buddha really meant it when he said it, and the things where he didn't really mean it when he said it. So in one case, when he didn't mean it is with changing things. He didn't mean to say about changing things that they didn't exist by definition. Okay, he didn't mean to say about changing things that they were just a creation of your projections. Okay, so we made that distinction back before. When did he mean to say it? Oh, when he got onto constructs. Okay, that's the third turning of the wheel's take on what he meant during the second turning of the wheel when he said, oh, things do exist. Constructs, on the other hand, don't exist by definition, and they are only constructs of your mind or only projections of your mind. So it was back in our presentation of the middle turning of the wheel
as it is interpreted by the third turning of the wheel, where we began to make this distinction between something existing just only as a projection of the mind, and then something existing not just as a projection of the mind, but from its own unique way of being, or by definition. Okay. Same distinction was made there. Nothing new. Love it. So remember we said we were going to have two interpretations of what the words exist deceptively and exist ultimately means, and here we're in the first version of what it means. They say, you know, if you want to appreciate it, this presentation of what it means to exist ultimately and what it means to exist deceptively, you have to go back to the second turning of the wheel. Okay, dole here, five lines from the bottom on page 53 means, from the middle turning of the wheel, from the sutras in which the middle of the turning of the wheel was done. You know, the sutra said nothing exists by definition. And then the mind-only school went back to that sutra and said, hey, it was talking about only constructs. Okay, it's only about constructs that middle turning of the wheel was speaking literally. Okay, so when it went into the meaning of not existing by definition, it was referring, and thereby meaning existing only in our projections, right? Existing only as projection. It was talking about constructs. Okay, back in the mind-only school's interpretation of the second turning of the wheel. And when the mind-only school was explaining, oh, there are parts of the second turning of the wheel which were spoken figuratively, which were not meant literally. They were talking about changing things. And it's not true of changing things that they're only a projection of the mind. They're anything but a projection of the mind. They exist by definition. They exist from their own side through their own unique way of being. So if you want to appreciate the first version of what it means to exist ultimately and what it means to exist deceptively, all you have to do is go back to the mind-only school's explanation of what the Buddha meant during the second turning of the wheel when he said, oh, nothing exists by definition. Okay. Nothing. Nothing. Now Jetsukapa makes a further statement about that first version of what it means to exist ultimately and what it means to exist deceptively. He says further, four lines from the bottom on page 56, but by the way, when you divide all the schools into two, right, and how do we do that? On one hand, we have all the middle way people, okay? And then on the other hand, we have everybody from the mind-only school on down to the detail, the sutras, the detailists, and even non-Buddhist schools, okay? And you go up to them and you divide them into two. These people are called middle way in this case, And everybody from the mind-only school on down, including non-Buddhist schools, are called people who profess functional things. People who say, people who talk about functional things. They're called Lopa Mala, means people who profess functional things. What does it mean to be a professor of functional things? It's a blanket description of anyone who believes that a thing which performs a function should exist in truth, should exist truly. Okay, people who insist that if something can perform a function, it must exist in truth. Okay, so you can lump together all of the schools from the mind-only school on down, even including non-Buddhist schools, and say these are people who say that if something functions, if something performs a function, it must exist. It must exist in truth. Okay, so that's what people who profess functional things means. Okay, so if you divide all people into these two great categories, right, and these people on the one hand are going to say about produced things, they do exist ultimately, and they don't exist deceptively, right? Everybody from the mind-only school on down, even out the door into the non-Buddhists, are going to say, okay, the same thing about changing things. They're going to say those things do exist ultimately, and they do not exist deceptively. And then on the other hand are the Madhyamika people. What are they going to say? They're going to say the direct opposite. You know, they're going to say, oh, nothing exists ultimately, and everything exists deceptively. Okay. Now, remember that we said there were going to be two descriptions of what it meant to exist ultimately and what it meant to exist deceptively. We have already given one of those descriptions. Okay. And it's that description which is the description you have to use when you talk about the war between this group and this group. When this group says, nothing exists ultimately, everything exists deceptively, and when this group, responds, no, you got it backwards. All these things exist ultimately, and they don't exist deceptively. Shenwang's right. Produce things. It is this description of what it is to exist ultimately, and it is this description of what it exists, what it means to exist deceptively, that forms the basis for their argument. Okay, so it's the first version of those two that is used to describe Shenwangs when you have a war between the middle way and everybody else about whether or not they exist deceptively and whether or not they exist ultimately. Listen, did you get that? Looking a little blank out there. You all right? Okay. Okay. And it's the same description of what it is to exist ultimately and what it is to exist nominally or deceptively that you have to use. You have to have the same idea of what those terms mean when you talk about the mind-only school's characterization of the first of their attributes as being something that exists only nominally and something that doesn't exist ultimately. Okay, you have to use that one when you think about the first of the three attributes of the mind-only school, about how they think about their own attributes. Okay, that's the one. These are the descriptions you have to use when you are describing the mind-only school's own beliefs about their three attributes. And when they say about the first attribute, which is constructs, right? Oh, these things don't exist ultimately. These things only exist nominally or deceptively. These are the connotations of the terms that they are thinking of when they say that. And when they say about the other two groups, which is what? Produce things and totality, right? When they say about those two things, these things do exist ultimately, and these things do not exist simply nominally or simply deceptively. This is the connotation of those terms that they have in mind when they say that. When they say that these latter two do exist ultimately, and they do not exist only nominally or only deceptively, they are thinking about those two terms in the sense that they have just been explained as the first version of those two terms. Nothing. Listen. Jesukaba is ending the description of the first connotations, the first set of connotations for those two phrases, and he says, when the Bodhisattva levels, Arya Sangha, and when the abbreviation, Arya Sangha, when they are talking about the first of the three groups and saying that these constructs are something that do not exist ultimately, but rather do exist deceptively or nominally, this is the connotation of those two phrases that they are thinking about, the first set of connotations, okay? And it's also this first set of connotations that they are talking about when they characterize the other two groups, the latter two groups, which is dependent things and totality or emptiness, and saying, oh, these things do exist ultimately, and they do not exist only deceptively or only in nominally. Okay, that's, again, Jetsukapa wraps up saying, this is what Arya Sangha means in those two books when he talks about something existing ultimately or something existing nominally. That's exactly what he has in mind, is the first set of connotations for those two terms. Just want to check in with you guys and make sure you got what we're talking about so far, okay? We're talking about the first way of establishing something as being ultimate and the first way of establishing something as being deceptive. And what this means is, in effect, what it means to exist ultimately and what it means to exist deceptively. Okay, that's what they're talking about. Okay, and I want to check in with you and make sure that you understand that in this first presentation of the connotations of those two phrases, that when we say something does exist ultimately, what we're saying is it is not simply a construct of the mind. It is not simply a projection. Rather, it exists from its own side, through its own unique way of being. And when we say, on the other hand, that something exists deceptively or something exists nominally, what we're saying is it exists only as a projection of the mind. It exists only as a creation of the mind. And it does not have the other kind of existence. Okay, it doesn't have any existence of coming from its own side through its own unique way of being. And that's what the first take on what those two phrases means is. Okay, we didn't get to the second take yet. Okay. So we don't have to keep reading in the book. I'm not going to quote the book now. I'm going to try to give you a hands-on example of what these two are. So, question for you guys. Okay, ready for a question. When we say that we are restricting or defining, when we say that we are restricting ourselves to the first explanation of what it is to exist ultimately, right? If we say we are restricting ourselves to the first version of what it means to exist ultimately, we keep saying, ultimate, 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 ultimate. What does ultimate mean? Rangi tumomi yungi duliki ngune jubadi is. Dundam to yopa say this. Topi tansa mayimba as. You said that doesn't exist only as projections. Could you elaborate on it just a bit? It seems to need a little bit of elaboration. It usually comes in two halves, right?
Right, right. Dope tatsa mayimba rangi tumamaya miduna kingdom and dubai. Everybody assent. Call over the Nicholas. So if you stuff your tummy, she won't have to eat.
No, I
eat meat. Not shot on you, good shot on
you.
Let me. If we restrict ourselves to this first interpretation of what it means when we say things exist ultimately, right? And it's just what you said. It's not just a projection. The thing does exist from its own side to its own unique way of being, okay? If you describe existing ultimately that way, which is the first of the two ways, right? Then how many of those three groups, okay, the three attributes of the mind-only school, to how many of those groups does that description apply? Which two? That's right. Now you got the first way of establishing what it means to exist ultimately. Now you understand it, okay? So now, again, restricting ourselves to the first way of explaining these two phrases, what does it mean for something to exist deceptively then? Rangi tumo me yembe duli kunguni madrupa chene tope taksa yimba yinkendi la disagrees. Kunzo tuyuma. So I guess you know, the venerable here can eat dinner and you guys won't have to eat dinner because you're all one mind stream, and feed the rest of you when he eats. That's the way it is. That's the way it is. Okay, so now that you've got it straight, what it means in the first interpretation of things for something to exist deceptively, how many of those three attributes do exist deceptively and how many don't? Yeah, you derived that from the other one, right? Is this clean now? Is this clean for everybody? Do we understand it? Is it clear? Okay. Listen. The presentation of the second interpretation of these two phrases begins on the seventh line from the bottom on page 55. Geshe-la says, look, we don't have time to go into the detail from the scripture on what the second version is. So I'm just going to consolidate it and give it to you all in one big hunk, okay? And just lay it on you. We got, you know, a little bit of time left. I'll just extemporaneously explain to you what it is. There's a lot of other issues to bring up before we actually get to the second one, but I don't want you to get confused. I don't want you to get, you know, to get it all mixed up. So let's just go to the second one. I'll give you a brief presentation of what it is.
Namda
Muscle.
Mm-hmm. Very easily, to present it very, very simply, okay? The meaning of the word ultimate in the second interpretation, when you say things exist ultimately or things don't exist ultimately, all it means is, all it's referring to, the ultimate here, is referring to totality, emptiness itself, okay? That's all it means there. In the second interpretation, it's just referring to totality, which is means emptiness itself. Defined in this school as the ultimate object of the path of purity. Remember that expression from the beginning of the book? The ultimate object of the path of purity, meaning that thing which the direct perception of emptiness perceives. Okay, is the definition in the mind-only school of what we call totality or emptiness. Okay, and to state it very, very simply, if you want to know what deceptive means in the phrase exist deceptively or something like that, those things which are deceptive are all other things. Okay, all other things, all those existing objects. He's careful to say that, right? All those existing objects, which cannot be characterized as being the object of the ultimate object of the path of purity, then that would be, in the second interpretation of these two phrases, the meaning of what it is to exist deceptively, or what deceptive objects are.
Mm-hmm.
So now, I got my other question out for you. When we are thinking about those three attributes or those three groups of things according to the mind-only school, now, how many of them exist ultimately according to this interpretation of what it means to exist ultimately? The chigma do yoma desu. Which one? Yongdu. Now, go on, this one's easy. Okay, so in the second way of interpreting things, how many of those three groups are what can be said to exist deceptively? That's it. So now is a quiz time, all right? Going back to the first interpretation of what it is, I'm sorry, let's state it differently. Don't forget that the Bodhisattva levels by Arya Sangha, in there he says over and over and over again that dependent things exist ultimately. He says over and over again that dependent things exist ultimately. Now, which of the two interpretations of existing ultimately is he referring to when he says that changing things exist ultimately? Josu Dombu Dres. That Changsa Nalia, Shewan de Dundan de Yopa Serigalia, Dundan de Yopa de Josu Dombu ki Dundan de Yopa Dres. Got that? Yep. Now we go back to those five groups of quotations, right, where someone's attacking the mind-only school. And one of those quotations said, once something has come from its causes and conditions, it can no longer be said to be ultimate. Which ultimate are we talking about now? Which of the two interpretations of ultimate are we talking about now? Nipadiyas. Josu Nipadiyas. Josu Nipadiyas. But you know, there's a problem. If you say that The mind, people who live in the mind-only school, okay, when they talk about, half the time when they talk about something exists ultimately, and they say, oh, things exist ultimately, in that case, they're referring to ultimate with one connotation. And then when they go around saying, nothing, things don't exist ultimately, and in that case, they're referring to ultimate with a wholly different connotation, doesn't that seem a little weird to you? That they're what do they call that? There's a word in English. They are, there's a technical word for that. They're changing the meaning of the word when they on different occasions. Yeah, there's a, what's it called? No. Sophistry, maybe, or something like that. Anyway, it's to use the same word, but to mean it in two different ways, according to your desires. You know,
ambiguity.
Yeah, no, there's a word. There's a technical word for it. Anyway, it's like sophistry or something like that. Yeah, depends on what it is. Depends on it. But if a minority school person comes up and says, yes, it's true that produced things do exist ultimately, then it's no problem for them to mean ultimately in the first connotation of it. Is that okay that they mean it in the first way? Is it okay to say that? In the minority school. Yeah, they would say it's okay. They'd say that's okay. It means it's not just a production of your mind. It's not just a fabrication of your mind. It really does exist from its own side. The pen and the like and everything. Now I ask you another question. Is it okay for a mind-only person to come up and say, dependent things don't exist ultimately, if they mean that ultimate in the second sense?
English.
Yeah, you can say that. In Jigelia, no, that turbo does no. Yeah, what you pointed out is the difference between is and its meaning as existing and is and its meaning as identification. And you say, I have money. No, you're saying it is not the ultimate. It has ultimateness or something like that. You see what I mean? The difference between being the ultimate and having ultimate nature or something like that. Yeah. Pecha yongre, digre. Nani. Nani. So there we have the mind-only school's method of avoiding any accusation that they are being contradictory, right? You know, all they have to say is, hey, when I said, Arya Sangha said in the Bodhisattva levels that dependent things exist ultimately, he was talking about ultimate in the first sense.
Okay? And when in those other five quotations, they say, hey, all those things don't exist ultimately. They were talking about ultimate in the second sense. It's no problem. We don't have any of those problems that you accuse us of. And this is the, remember, that's the name of the whole section. The name of the whole section was the way in which they avoid the apparent inconsistencies. They just, there's a word for that. What is that? It's where you change the meaning of the term halfway through your argument. And so you don't have any problems. Anyway, okay. Digging in.
Guess I was going back to a really, really, I think we promised to go back to this earlier. It's page 54, second line. I think we might have made a mark there. He said, this wording is really, really nasty. Okay? And it really, really is. What the wording means literally in English is that consciousness which remains in a state of where it has accustomed itself to, it has thoroughly accustomed itself to names according to the expression. Okay? Something like that, like almost like gibberish, you know. Like it doesn't make any sense. Krishna says, hey, look, just take that whole section. Just take that whole line and a half, second line to the third line of page 54, and all that's referring to is the constructing state of mind, okay? The mind which is projection, making a projection, or the mind which is making a construction, a construct, okay? Take it like that. And then in the following line it says, let's talk about its object, you know, the object which this state of mind is focusing on, okay? And then it says, that object is that thing, that physical form, that visible form. This is the sukdigi, migin namashabi, sukhichidire, sukhichidire. Then it says, that thing which is called form, which possesses the name, that form which possesses the name of form. Okay? Then it says, that form which possesses the name of form. That object, what's the name? That form which is the thing which possesses the name form. How's that? Okay? And it says, let's talk about that. That particular thing, which acts as the object of that particular state of mind, neither exists substantially, neither does it exist ultimately. Okay? having said that, you know, when the book, when Dua, right, the abbreviation, says about anything, that thing which neither exists substantially nor exists ultimately, they must be talking about constructs, okay? They must be talking about constructs, okay? They don't exist substantially, and they don't exist ultimately. They must be talking about constructs. Therefore, you can assume, says Geshe-la, that when they talk about the object of the mind here, they're not talking about physical matter or form in the sense of a shenwang, in the sense of a dependent thing. They must be talking about the object it thinks it sees, as opposed to the object it's focused upon. Okay, the object it thinks it sees is kundan, okay, is constructs. So when they go through this very, very difficult wording, and they're talking about that form, which is the thing which is given the name form, Geshe-la says, this is so arcane, the wording here is so obscure, that I'm not even sure we can take it to mean constructs in the traditional sense of the meaning of the term constructs. It must be talking about something, you know, that's close to a construct. It doesn't seem to be saying quite construct. It seems to be saying even something, a little bit of a variation on a construct. Okay? That's what I mean. So whatever this object is, okay, we're not talking about the actual object of the eye consciousness, right? We're not talking about the thing that you're looking at. We're talking about something that you think you see, right? And it's getting close to a construct, right? It seems to be a variant on a construct. And then it says further, this thing does not exist substantially, and this thing does not exist ultimately. So what it's saying, in effect, is, and the following lines state it, what it's implying then is that since the thing doesn't exist ultimately, it must exist, I'm sorry, doesn't exist substantially, it must exist as a labeled thing. Remember the distinction we had between existing substantially and existing as a labeled thing? So I guess you got to throw this object, whatever it is, right, this almost construct, you have to throw it in the category of labeled things, first of all. Secondly, because it said not to exist ultimately, you're going to have to throw it into the category of things called deceptive objects, deceptive things. Okay. So there's two things we can say about this object, whatever it is. It doesn't exist ultimately, meaning it exists deceptively. It doesn't exist substantially, meaning it exists as a labeled thing. Those are the two things you can say. And that's the whole section, very, very difficult wording in Tibetan, which is actually a translation from Sanskrit, which doesn't help, on page 54, about two-thirds of the way down. That's what that part is saying. Now, more difficult Tibetan here, very difficult. And Geshe-la says, you know, we're just running the bulldozer through it right now. We'll try to clean up the mess tomorrow, okay? Like, I'm just trying to run through it for you quickly. We'll get to it in more detail tomorrow, okay? But just to bulldoze through it right now, page 54, eighth line from the bottom. Here they start describing a state of mind which is sawa. Sawa means devoid of here. It means which is cleared away of, meaning which does not possess any such total familiarity with the expressions. Now, what the heck does that mean? Okay, Nagishla is opposing visual consciousness to the conceptualization of a color, for example. Okay, so one thing you can think of, if I say blue and you're thinking about blue and you close your eyes and you try to think of blue, that would be the state of mind described in line 3. That was the one that we already talked about. What? The one that was taking this almost construct, right? And it was focusing on an almost construct. If you think about it, that state of mind where you imagine blue, for example, is focusing on some kind of a construct, really, of blue. It's not focusing on blue itself. And it depends on some kind of familiarity or intimacy with ideas and not real things, okay? With what we call expressions here, meaning concepts, okay? And then when it gets down to the other part, eight lines from the bottom of page 54, they're talking about a state of mind which is clear, or which is free of any such total familiarity with concepts. Now we're talking about the direct perception of blue. We're talking about your eye consciousness's understanding of blue, which is more direct and does not depend on some kind of intimacy with concepts. You see what I mean? It's rather depending on just plain old direct perception of blue. Okay, and now we're talking about, if we talk about that state of mind, make a number shift.
What is that?
Now it becomes clear, okay, after all this stuff. All right, this is nice. Okay, pay attention to this one. When we talk about the object of that second state of mind, which is what? Which is a direct visual perception of blue. Okay? Now, the object that thing holds does exist substantially and does exist ultimately. And that's the whole point. Okay? Now it all becomes clear. Okay? That second state of mind, the object that it's focusing on, which is blue itself, right? Which is Shen Wang. Okay? Does exist ultimately and does exist substantially. So Gisla says, let's take that can of worms, shove all the worms down in the can, lock the top of the can, stick it under my seat here. Forget the can, forget the verbiage, okay? Forget the expressions, forget the words, okay? Let's just go to the meaning of what they're saying here, okay? Forget all these extremely difficult Tibetan words here. What are they talking about? They're saying, when you are sitting there and imagining blue, right? When you have a mental construct of blue, right? When you are thinking about blue, that blue that you are thinking about is something that is not a Shenwang, okay? It is not a produced thing. It is a construct, okay? As a construct, it cannot be said to exist substantially. It cannot be said to exist ultimately, okay? It's rather something that exists as a labeled thing. It's rather something that exists deceptively or nominally only, okay? So finish the book on that one, okay? Now, when you're talking about the object of a visual consciousness, when you're talking about looking at blue itself, then that it does qualify as a produced thing, as a dependent thing. It does qualify as a substantial thing insofar as it's a functional thing. Since it's a functional thing, we can say it's a substantial thing. Okay? And then it does qualify as something that does exist ultimately. So that's all it's saying here. Okay? That's all the point is here.
Nothing.
Maybe tomorrow we'll let a few worms out on this point. Okay, we'll re-examine this issue tomorrow. And maybe we'll let a few of those worms out. Okay, we'll go into it a little deeper tomorrow. Nothing. Okay, we'll finish there. You ready, Pamela?